that will take all of these scenarios and then you feed them through this virtual car in this virtual world, which we call a digital twin, and verify that it has correct behavior all before the car is actually built and before the silicon is physically in your hands. That's the solution to the problem.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. As you probably have come to discover, if you listen to our past episodes, our work as it relates to the automotive industry tends to be pretty global. In this week's episode, your usual host, Jeff, is joined by me. My name is Connor Pike, and I am another writer with Mentor, a Siemens business. In this episode, Jeff and I interviewed David Fritz. David works at Mentor in the World Trade Association. He says it's best to think of him as being on special assignment. He works to pull together products within Siemens and Mentor, combining them in a manner that solves high-value, compelling problems in the automotive space. David's focus is specifically on autonomous vehicles. We talk about the semiconductor world in this episode, and before we kick things off, I want to share the overview David provided on hardware emulation, a key technology in moving forward to autonomous vehicles.
I wouldn't suggest this, but if you opened up your smartphone and you looked inside, you would see these chips inside there. And those chips are made up of transistors, often billions of those transistors. And it's a very lengthy and complicated process, turning the logic that you want to operate inside that chip into something physical that you can touch and put into a device like your phone. So what emulation does is it allows you to simulate or emulate that chip before it's actually fabricated into something that you could put into the phone. And that's a critical way of trying to accelerate how quickly you can take one of these chips to market. And it's really a technology that has changed everything from obviously smartphones to digital TVs to now your vehicle. Your vehicle now has hundreds of these chips in them. As they get bigger and bigger and more complex, the more important it is to actually more thoroughly ensure that they're working properly before you actually put them into a car. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would rather have things very thoroughly tested before I hopped into a car and said, you know, drive me across the country. So that technology is a critical enabler to what's going to happen or is happening in the autonomous vehicle space.
Next, we asked him to share a bit about his background and how he came to be at Mentor.
A little bit about my background. Before I came to Mentor about 2 years ago, I was at Qualcomm, where I was a senior director for program management, and my team was responsible for pretty much all aspects of the Snapdragon chipset. And before that, I was at NVIDIA, where I was a chip manager for the Tegra 5 chip, which is turns out a predecessor to Parker, which is currently in the autopilot for Tesla.
Part of the goal of these discussions is just to get to know some of the folks that we have here working on automotive and sort of how they got into the space. I was looking just at your LinkedIn profile before we talked, and you've had quite an interesting background. You started your career at TI in the 80s, and then it looks like you did a whole bunch of startups that were interesting. If you were going to sort of briefly talk about what you did prior to NVIDIA and Qualcomm, what stands out? What was sort of the most fun that you did in these various startups?
Yeah, great question. Interestingly enough, you know, when you're doing startups, particularly in Silicon Valley, it really changes how you approach problems. And I think I brought a lot of that to Mentor, and you can see that in some of our new product offerings. And, you know, we've done everything from very early synthesis of CPUs and GPUs and digital signal processors and applying those. The company that I was a CEO of for 14 years was actually partnering with Intel and a couple other companies to get the whole USB product line launched across the board. And that was a lot of fun. And we saw a lot of interesting trends happening with that. And then went to work for Zilog. And at Zilog, I was working with a team that was the very first to have an embedded web server. And that was an interesting thing, and it opened up a whole lot of horizons. Now you see web servers and everything from printers and, of course, smartphones and laptops. We're seeing web servers and smartwatches and everything. And it all kind of started with that very early work. And I thought that was something that I like to bring forward. The fact that if you look a couple of steps ahead, you can make smarter decisions about where you're putting your time and effort today. And when you apply that to autonomous vehicles, that applies in spades, because there are certain things that are really clear for autonomy that simply cannot be done the way they've been done before. And I went from Zilog, and from there, I was a VP of marketing for a company called ARC International, which was an ARM competitor. So we did a lot of clever things there, and I moved on from that to NVIDIA. Well, actually, there was an intermediate company that was run by Intel called Solistix. And Solistix did asynchronous design, meaning they were doing clockless logic design. All those things that I've mentioned so far apply almost directly to what we're trying to do here at Mentor and Siemens to address the challenges of the automotive industry, particularly when it comes to addressing autonomy. And of course, NVIDIA is an obvious fit, and then Qualcomm is as well. So it's a little bit like, you know, Steve Jobs said when he was speaking at Stanford's graduation before he passed away, and that, you know, while you're going through this process, it all seems like chaos and you don't really understand why things are happening in a certain way. But when you get further down the line, you can take a step back and sort of see how all the dots connected to get you where you are today. And that's very much how I feel about what we're doing here at Mentor and Siemens.
Trying to smarten up a bit, Jeff looked up some of David's previous companies to prep for our conversation. His background taps into what's really great and fun about the technology industry. Interestingly enough, when he came across ARC International, the first thing that showed up was a family-owned French company that is the leading manufacturer of crystal and glass tableware in the world. They also license Pyrex cookware. So, are they also a semiconductor company? Talk about diversifying your investments. David provided some additional context to clear this up for us.
ARC International was really a spin-out of ARM in the early days. And yeah, and it was really interesting. Steve Ferber, who has shortly become Sir Steve Ferber from the University of Manchester, he's also doing Spinnaker, which is trying to mimic the human brain. I think they have the first million CPU brain modeling system. So he actually started in ARM with Acorn when it was Acorn. And then he was involved in getting the whole ARC International thing going as well. And so there are a lot of former ARM people there. And it was interesting technology. It was the first configurable CPU technology where you could essentially build your own CPU. And we competed against Tensilica as well.
After spending so much time at smaller semiconductor companies in a senior role, we wanted to know what brought David back to the big chip companies in 2012, from NVIDIA to Qualcomm, and now finally at Mentor, which works with those companies quite a bit.
It wasn't so much coming to a big chip company that was the allure. It was, you know, my background is mathematics, computer science, electrical engineering, and I spent so much time managing, doing business plans and corporate reports and dealing with investors. I just felt like I was disconnected from where the technology was going. So when the opportunity came up at NVIDIA, I jumped at it. Now, when I joined NVIDIA, it was really interesting because NVIDIA was two companies. There was a company south of San Tomas Freeway that was the GPU stalwart part of the company, very disciplined, have everything under control. I mean, they're just incredibly awesome people. On the north side of San Tomas Freeway were the gunslingers. Those were the guys and gals who were trying to put together solutions that would take them beyond the GPU space, which is now, you know, part of what's involved for their autopilot that they actually sold the components for to NVIDIA. And there's also a link between NVIDIA. A lot of people don't know this, that Elon Musk and Jensen Huang of NVIDIA are good buddies. So I remember those days where I was at NVIDIA and we would just show up for work one day and there'd be like 20 Teslas parked in the parking lot. And you actually got to sit in them and go see what they were like. And in those days, they were really novel because there really weren't very many of them. And then the next day, you may show up and the whole cafeteria was closed down because you had an opportunity to try out the latest and greatest video games. And that was a showcase because NVIDIA GPUs were an important part of that. So I saw the Tesla in the early days as the merging of that video game and display and 3D GPU technology into, in this case, IVI or in-vehicle infotainment. And, you know, that turned on a lot of possibilities. But what was most interesting about the time at NVIDIA was when Jensen actually said that we need to move at the speed of light to compete against companies like Qualcomm and Samsung. And what that meant was that by the time we taped out a chip and sent it off for fabrication, all of the software also had to be fully validated. Now, that was a revolutionary concept because up until that time, the only way to test your software was to wait until the silicon comes back and you put it on a printed circuit board and then you fire it up. The other alternative was, okay, you could put it into an FPGA and run some of your software. But we were getting to the point where implementing these huge systems on a chip in an FPGA was a major problem. So that meant that we had to come up with something that was a very different approach. So the concept was, why don't we do something that's currently called hybrid emulation? It didn't have a name back then because it hadn't been invented back then. So I somehow became in charge of making sure that this concept became a reality and worked with one of NVIDIA's biggest vendors. And we cobbled together, boy, I tell you, it was duct tape and binder's twine and a little bit of chewed gum to put everything together to make this thing work so that we could take this design of this chip before it ever existed and actually run the full software on that so that the software can be debugged in an environment that was very, very, very close to what the silicon would be when it actually came back. And as an end result of that program, once the silicon did come back, bring up happened in just a week or two, and we had samples of hardware and software in a customer's hands shortly after that. That was the speed of light, as Jensen called it. Interestingly enough, about that time, I got a phone call from one of my good buddies from TI. He was like employee number 500 at Qualcomm. He was a senior VP at the time, who actually tried to convince me to join this little bitty company of about 50 people in San Diego called Qualcomm. And I wouldn't go. One of my biggest mistakes of my life. He calls me up and says, hey, I hear you're at the competition. We can't have that. We need to get you here to Qualcomm. And it took a year, and honestly, I talked to about 30 people at Qualcomm before I decided to move from NVIDIA to Qualcomm, pick up the whole family, move from Silicon Valley down to San Diego. And when I got there, lo and behold, what Qualcomm was trying to do was very, very similar to what NVIDIA had just accomplished. So I spent a lot of time there trying to bring that same sort of technology from that very same EDA vendor into Qualcomm. And I've been there, I don't know, several years, and I got a phone call from the people I'd been working with in NVIDIA and Qualcomm. And they said, well, we're leaving our company and we're going to join Mentor. And remember all the work that was almost but not completely done at NVIDIA? Yeah. So remember all the things that we needed at Qualcomm? Yes. We have all that at Mentor. We need somebody to come and help us make this real and make it into a product that we can sell generally to everybody, and not just those two companies who were the only two companies on the planet that had the technology. And that's how I came to Mentor.
Mobile devices, iPhone, Android, and so forth, have been the largest driver behind the semiconductor industry in the last few years. But that appears to be changing. I asked David if he saw the automotive industry taking over that role, and what his thoughts were on automotive's role in the semiconductor industry moving forward.
The same sorts of consolidation that we saw, if you go back and if you could even find an old Nokia phone and you crack that thing open, you would find there were many, 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 many small chips all communicating together. One of the technologies that changed that whole industry and opened up the door for Samsung and Apple and all of those suppliers like Qualcomm was something called system on a chip. So instead of having a bunch of these little chips from hundreds of different vendors, you would take all of that logic and you put it on the single chip. And when you do that, if you imagine that, well, let me take a half step back. So, you know, I heard about a year and a half ago from Audi that they projected for an autonomous vehicle, there would be over 200 of these printed circuit boards spread throughout a vehicle. And a couple of months ago, I was in Yokohama, Japan, listening to a Volkswagen executive speak, and they were saying that they believe in 8 to 10 years, instead of 200, there will be three. And there will be redundancy, but there will be three very large chips. And most of the logic on how your vehicle behaves, how it senses the environment around it, the decisions that it makes, all those things are going to be located into those three very large chips. So if you think about that, we've just taken very literally hundreds of yards of heavy cabling in that vehicle. And instead of a wire being meters long, it's now shrunk into nanometers long. And what that means is the weight is dramatically reduced. That means the processing time accelerates in this hockey stick, very high rate. And those are going to be fundamental changes to the automotive industry, because instead of having hundreds of companies trying to do this, there's going to be massive consolidation throughout the industry as that logic all gets consolidated. And it is exactly the same trajectory we've seen from personal computers and smartphones and lots of other industries. So I think it's inevitable that that kind of change is going to happen for automotive. And you can see that the suppliers like Bosch, Conti, Aptiv, all those companies, if you look at their press releases, they're saying very, very similar things, that they need to adopt to this new way of doing things, which was pioneered before them and completely changed many different industries. And it's coming, and they've got to adapt to be able to work within that environment. Even the OEMs, you see massive partnerships between companies A and B, trying to have some sort of collaborative approach to address this massive increase in complexity of these systems and the technology that's driven these other industries as it is now encroaching upon the automotive industry. And you can see that physically happening, you know, Samsung buying Harman, Intel buying Mobileye, the list goes on and on, where these merging of technology and conventional, we call them mechatronics or electromechanical things like braking and steering, all those things are now consolidating and coming together. If you're thinking about pure electronic vehicles, now we've just extended the range because it's much lighter. It can take a lot less processing power to actually do the things that need to be done. So you can see what's happened in the semiconductor industry is the driver, or one of the serious drivers of the fundamental disruption in automotive for the next decade or two.
Do you expect that the big automotive OEMs will, are they going to try and get on this consolidation train, as it were? Do you think they will try and bring some of this in-house?
Yes. I know. Another anecdote, about 2 years ago, I was in Detroit and I made the statement that, guys, I believe within 5 years, the automotive OEMs will be producing their own chips. And everybody laughed. That's ridiculous. Nobody's going to do that. Well, I'm here to say today, I was absolutely totally wrong, because I didn't know it at the time, but they were already doing it. And we're seeing them building up new teams. We're seeing the OEMs acquiring companies that have the capacity to build these chips for them. And this whole consolidation is already well underway. I have many. I'm going to give you one that's fairly benign, because I don't know who's going to be listening to this podcast. But we've been talking to Audi for quite some time about our product offering that allows you to create a full digital twin long before these chips actually exist, which is a critical technology moving things forward. And they introduced us to their subsidiary called AID in Munich. And I walked in and their CEO met me and I said, wow, you know, this is just like walking into a startup in Silicon Valley. His eyes lit up and he puffed his chest out like, you know, that was the best compliment that I ever could have made. And then I spent the day listening to them go through presentation after presentation about what they're doing. And in all honesty, I think the world is going the same direction as Tesla. A lot of these autonomous vehicles started with the NVIDIA GPU as a research vehicle. And I do think it was fine for that, as long as you didn't mind it taking up the entire trunk. And in the early days, they actually had to be water-cooled, otherwise it could catch on fire. So as a research vehicle, I think it was fine, but they're all now moving, as Tesla has said publicly they're going to do, into building their own AI chips to get around some of these power and performance issues that we've all experienced trying to solve this problem with the same technology that you use on your computer to play games. That's a GPU, graphics processing unit. So it's a little bit like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole to solve these problems with the GPU, and the world has realized that. And that's actually a catalyst for actually building your own chips, because now you can empirically show that you have a better solution and differentiate against the competition by taking your own design and using other ways to solve these artificial intelligence problems besides GPUs.
With every technical solution, there comes a set of challenges. We asked David to expand on the problems that the automotive space brings to chip design. What was it about a GPU that was initially so exciting for autonomous drive? And what led to the realization that it's no longer the best solution?
You know, the problems to be solved are twofold. One, there's the machine learning side of things, where you take something called a neural network. Think of it as a software construct. And then you put these, let's take imaging, or perception is the easiest one, right? So you take this camera image and then you push it through the network and you say, you should have recognized this as a cat, and it doesn't. So you go back, it's called back propagation if you're into this sort of thing. And then you say, that should have been a cat. You make appropriate changes and you iterate through this and it says, okay, that's a cat. Then you go find a different image of a cat and you do the same thing all over again until you finally reach the point where this neural network, this implementation of artificial intelligence, recognizes at a reasonable rate what it sees as a cat. And then what you do is you say, okay, here's a dog. And you push the dog image through it. And it says, I think that's a cat. And you say, nope, that's a dog. And then you iterate over and over. So what you're doing is you're consolidating into this network of, well, to be technical, they're really synapses and neurons that we're modeling, just how the human brain works, until it understands this is a cat and this is a dog, and you continue through that process. This is a yield sign, this is a stop sign, this is a person, this is a bicycle. You can imagine it takes an incredible amount of time and processing power until what you actually ended up with is correct most of the time. And one of my most popular presentations I've given a few times has to do with the fact that you've gone through that process and you've trained it not just for dogs and cats, but you've trained it for a baby. You need to recognize, you know, a toddler walks out in front of the street, or this is a ball, that sort of thing. And there's a real life case scenario whereby using this same technology of machine learning that I just described, a vehicle is driving down the road all by itself, and it sees that there's actually a baby in the middle of the road, and it's going 130 kilometers per hour. So it's highly unlikely that anybody's just going to drop off a baby in the middle of the highway. And yet the vehicle actually sees that as a baby, and it decides that even though there's a car in its blind spot, it's better to change lanes because statistically the car in its blind spot will avoid a collision. So it makes that decision. And then the car in the blind spot actually swerves too quickly because it's being driven by a human, and it smashes into a tree. When you get actually closer to the baby, it actually turns out that the outline of the baby matched very closely to the outline of a cat. And in reality, it wasn't a baby in a road, but it was a cat. And you can imagine the papers the next day saying, oh, you know, autonomous vehicle injures family of four, to avoid hitting a cat. And then the CEO always comes back and says, wasn't my fault. That sort of thing happens a lot. So in reality, some of the complexities of what's going on is we've taken a technology that's only a few years old, and we've applied it in new and original ways without having the opportunity to go back and look at things with a broader view. So that's why we're seeing casualties and fatalities, because we're actually applying this technology, which is relatively simple to understand if you study it. And then we're using things like GPUs, which were intended for graphics processing, to emulate this technology and then put that thing into a car. So because the industry has jumped the gun like that, we're seeing, I like to call it, a circling of wagons of different governments and regulatory bodies to try to bring in regulation into this process. I mean, we regulate whether or not you can put your cell phone onto an AT&T network, but we don't regulate whether or not the object that actually kills more humans on this planet than guns, and then we set it off to go drive itself. So because the whole industry jumped the gun, because they haven't really refined the technology to the point where it's going to be able to do this properly, now we have to deal with the specter of regulation. The other negative side of jumping the gun is the fact that now consumer confidence in the ability or willingness to put your life in the hands of an autonomous vehicle has dropped dramatically. So about a year or so ago, I saw a survey that said less than 30% of Americans would feel comfortable getting into an autonomous vehicle. That number drops to almost zero if that autonomous vehicle makes a mistake. So this is another example of, you know, getting out ahead of your skis. And, you know, that's sort of the flip side of the Silicon Valley approach to, you know, least common viable or minimum viable product, MVP they call it, and putting that on the road. So a lot of what we're doing at Mentor and Siemens is to address the trust issue, to address the liability issue, and ensure that the chips that are behind all of this decision-making and the software that runs upon them are all tested in an environment that is close to reality as possible, so that we can show that in these unusual scenarios that the vehicle is actually making the correct decision and making that decision in a way that the occupants of the vehicle can actually survive. Because it's very easy to avoid an accident by an autonomous vehicle and generate so many G's in certain directions that would actually cause concussion or even death of the occupants, regardless of restraints. So those are the types of complexities that we're dealing with, and the fact that we haven't found a way to date to deal with all of them simultaneously sort of leaves gaps in how all of this is handled throughout the vehicle. We need to find a way to resolve all of that in a holistic manner. And in essence, that is essentially what our digital twin is for automotive.
You talk about Silicon Valley getting out ahead of its skis or whatnot. One of the fun parts of my job and Connor's is because we're writers and communication folks, we get paid to, you know, watch YouTube videos. And there is, I've seen in a presentation that you gave, there's the Tesla driver going around the curve of death with autopilot. And it's funny, there you could do nothing else for a few weeks but watch user-generated Tesla videos, which is another podcast. It's incredible what's out there. But given your background, what you know about SoCs, your time in NVIDIA, when you look at that Tesla curve of death video, thinking about it from the point of view of what's going on in the silicon, what do you see?
Wow. Yeah. So if I combine those two questions, I think it may help me answer it. So at the most simplistic level, for an autonomous vehicle, you have sensing. You have knowledge of what it is around you, sort of in a sphere or a 3D bubble around the vehicle. And you have to understand what those objects are and how they're interacting. So that is sensing. And if you could actually do your sensing within a virtual world, where you could control the scenarios, then you could test things like, you know, what kind of decision is this vehicle going to make if it's driving over a bridge in San Francisco during an earthquake? And I don't care if you drive 100 billion miles, you may never, by randomness, actually get a physical autonomous vehicle in that scenario. So you can't really say what decision it would make. So sensing and 3D representation of the world around it accurately in a physics-based way is critical to solving this problem. Now, once you have sensed what's around you, then that needs to go into something that's actually going to make intelligent decisions about that. And you can see, you know, in the press, they talk about path planning and things like that, things that have a direct correlation back to the DARPA contest for the first autonomous vehicle to complete the course. And in all honesty, from an engineering perspective, those were revolutionary, but they are very simplistic solutions and ways of making decisions. And as I was saying earlier, talking about artificial intelligence, the methodology that we use for artificial intelligence today and how that relates to what's coming from the sensors, that is problematic. And most companies that are deep into this are looking at new approaches to that problem, which is a whole other podcast. We could go into that for hours at a time, what those solutions are, because we have a very good visibility into that. But the silicon that's actually running all of that needs to be understanding of exactly what kinds of algorithms are in that logic and how they can do that most efficiently. So there you would actually make a decision. And then what you do is you would send that decision to the actuators in a car, you know, the braking system, the steering and transmission, the engine control, all those sorts of things. And those actually have to model very closely what the vehicle is actually going to do. They have to model things like tire friction. They have to model force on the brake calipers. You know, they have to model, you know, what happens to the vehicle and how its weight distribution is as you're steering left or right by 30 degrees. And then once you have that model of what the vehicle is physically doing within that 3D space, that changes what you sense on the next iteration around. And when you think about that, then we have sensing, we have decision-making, we have acting and sensing. Now we have what's called a closed loop. So in a closed loop environment, truly what we're doing is we're building a virtual representation that's accurate to the real vehicle. And that vehicle is driving itself within a 3D representation of the world around it. And we get to control the scenarios. We can randomize them. We can do things like, okay, drive through this scenario in the city. This is what happens. Yes, we avoided the accident. Now, what if it's snowing? Now, what if it's raining? Now, what if that baby carriage is actually a cow or a horse or make all of these things? And there are databases out there now, and they're growing daily, that will take all of these scenarios and then you feed them through this virtual car in this virtual world, which we call a digital twin, and verify that it has correct behavior all before the car is actually built and before the silicon is physically in your hands. That's the solution to the problem.
Given David's background and his time spent in Silicon Valley, Jeff wanted to ask him about his thoughts on the future of the automotive industry. Will it become a winner-take-all space, or will we have the automotive equivalent of iOS versus Android?
If you projected out in time in the auto industry, and again, realizing it's just a guess, but would you see it? Is this going to be a winner-take-all, a winner-take-some? Is there going to be one OEM who gets this right and has a locked-down, fully integrated hardware-software stack? And then there's going to be some technology vendor that's the equivalent of Android that other car companies license, and the world's going to be broken into two or three solutions, and that's going to be it? Or what would you see? There's no penalty for getting it wrong because we're just riffing on what we think might happen. But what do you see when you look down the road 25 years and how this, there's a million people doing full stack stuff right now and all sorts of money washing around, but certainly there's going to be some sort of shakeout. What would you predict?
Well, I think what's going to happen is I think the industry is going to stratify both vertically and horizontally. I think they are going to be several OEM winners, and eventually they're not going to be able to differentiate in the same way they're differentiating now. They're going to be able to differentiate not by, hey, this is a luxury car brand, but this is a level 100 safety car brand. So you can almost see like a Volvo fitting into that sort of thing. You can see other companies saying, well, this is the low end. You know, these are expensive vehicles, but we have an econo version of an autonomous vehicle that you could afford to have in your garage or sell hundreds or thousands of them to robo-taxi services or things like that. So I think they're going to stratify into their target markets, which are probably more varied than we could imagine today. I think underneath that, you're going to see IP providers like we did with smartphone technology, right? We're going to say, oh, well, rather than you training your vehicle how to recognize these objects, we're going to provide you a database that you would incorporate directly into your vehicle, and we'll have done all that for you. That's the sort of thing I think happening. So I think there are new industries that are going to build up underneath this. We're going to see tons of consolidation. I think companies like Volkswagen that has 12 brands underneath them probably have the best chance of long-term survival because they can diversify and they can try different vertical markets and see which ones pan out over time. I see a lot faster movement in places like China and Germany than I'm currently seeing in Detroit, to my chagrin. I mean, I wish Detroit would move a little faster than they seem to be moving. So I worry a little bit about the US's role in this, you know, 20 years from now.
Finally, Jeff and I asked David a series of rapid-fire questions.
All right, so David, the first rapid-fire question, and we are going to keep you on the clock here. Where do you like to go for news, I guess specifically automotive or technology-related news?
I like to go to Wired.
Excellent. It's a stalwart brand that's still around.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out the paywall. I like it. Number two, what would you say in a nutshell, in a sentence, what's the biggest thing standing in the way of full Level 4, Level 5 autonomy, the biggest technical hurdle to getting there?
A full digital twin that can run scenarios faster than 10 frames per second.
All right. Number three. So how about advice to someone who wants to get into the field?
Well, you have to clarify at what level. You mean they want to...
Let's go maybe entry level, getting into IC design or any sort of semiconductor.
I think the next big change in industry is putting more intelligence into sensing in a cost-effective way. This takes us into something called point clouds, which is a whole other podcast. Love to get into it sometime.
So that's podcast number three.
Yeah, let's talk about point clouds and how that's going to change the industry.
Last question, and then we'll wrap up here. So what's the best part about your job? What are you most engaged in on a day-to-day basis? Most fun for you?
The most fun is to see how the Silicon Valley culture is being adopted by automotive companies and how revolutionary ideas that for me are decades old are changing the culture of the companies that are adopting them. You know, I'm sometimes, my colleagues call me Marty McFly because sometimes I feel like I'm in the past and I'm from the future and I'm trying to drag these automotive companies into the future and I tell them what the future holds and they don't believe me. And I say, this is the future. I've been there. I come from there. This is the way it's going. And to see them agree over time that, yes, that's the direction it's going is very satisfying.
Special thanks to David Fritz for joining us today. And for more, visit Siemens PLM Software online. Siemens PLM Software is a world-leading provider of product lifecycle management and manufacturing operations management software. We help thousands of companies realize innovation by optimizing their processes from planning and development through manufacturing, production, and support. Thank you very much for listening.